How much does this book weigh?
4.5 pounds.
Wow, it's a lunker.
I love it.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson. If I sound a bit different, it's because I'm recording this part of the program from a makeshift studio at home. In February 2020, I had the pleasure of speaking with Trouty Perry, Mary Manning, and Aaron Teasdale of the Voices of Yellowstone's Capstone, a narrative atlas of the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness. Stay with us.
This book is called Voices of Yellowstone's Capstone, a narrative atlas of the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness, and all proceeds go to support the Associated Wilderness Foundation. First of all, for listeners who aren't familiar, can you describe the region this book covers?
Be glad to. It's nearly a million acres, and it's mostly high-altitude plateau. So an Arctic region at the northeast corner of Yellowstone National Park, which is partly why we called it Yellowstone's Capstone. It's also home to many Arctic species, I think. Mary can help me with this, but many Arctic species, intact species, as well as the full suite of predators and prey that existed at the time of Lewis and Clark. So it's a pretty special area.
And Trouty, about the book you write, though this is an atlas complete with maps, it is not a guidebook. Instead, in the way that wilderness users explore physical trails on the landscape, we'd like for readers to explore intellectual trails of the atlas. Tell me about the concept of a narrative atlas.
Yeah. When I was approached by the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness Foundation to be a board member, I said, I have a better idea. I'm more project-oriented, and I had seen Rebecca Solnit's atlases from the cities, particularly New Orleans, where I went after Katrina, and I was fascinated by how she combined maps with the essays to tell these wonderful stories. So the maps are what bring you in, the illustrations on the maps, they tell a story, and then you go into the essays to learn more. So I was hoping that we would be able to apply something like that to the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness, which didn't have a lot written about it. And as you mentioned, we don't necessarily need a guidebook to say, take this trail, take that trail. What we need is a way to reach people, to create connection, to inform, to raise awareness. And some of my favorite essays in the book are the ones that sort of at the margin that people don't know much about. And maybe Mary's is an example of that.
Mary, how did you get involved in the project?
Well, I'll defer to Trouty. Do you want to tell that story?
Well, yes. When the board liked my idea about the narrative atlas, they also told me that Dr. Jesse Logan is my co-editor, was on a similar thought process. And his was probably more traditional, like there's a similar atlas of the Yellowstone. So it was going to be maps of resources, like maybe the range of a grizzly bear, for example. And he and I went together and kind of put together a table of contents. And we had this initial idea of physical resources like geology, glaciers, biological resources like aspen and fox and pika, and then human stories and the human sense of place. But through the process of writing the book, it evolved because humans have been on this landscape for a long time. And our stories are intertwined with the resources. And it isn't a good idea, in my mind, to separate humans from wilderness. Wilderness is not something that should be set aside, and we think that it's, you know, once we designate it as wilderness, it's protected forever. Humans have interacted on a daily basis with this landscape for a long, long time. And so that's the story we emerged with.
The book is filled with these gorgeous maps, photographs, and artwork. In terms of the artistic vision and design of the book, what did you want it to do for the imagination?
We wanted to fire the imagination. Again, I need to step back and say that the beauty of the book is attributable to our book designer, Adrian Pollard. As I said, Jesse and I had maps in mind. We had narrative in mind. Adrian's the one who made it beautiful. And she marched right with us. It was meant to inspire. It was meant to, fire the imagination and have people take away a sense of connection, but also a sense of responsibility, understand what our impacts may be, and then, you know, create a sense of stewardship.
As you were shaping the content and as the book came together, what values emerged?
The values that emerged for me was it initially started as a celebration of the cultural and natural resources that are so obvious, and the idea that we needed to raise awareness about some of those resources at the margins that people know very little bit about. But we also wanted to talk about this human interaction with this landscape over time. As I said before, it was initially kind of separated, and we wanted to talk about how we're actually a part of this wilderness, and we shouldn't see ourselves as separate. We shouldn't see it as a set-aside. Also, the idea that it's a community. All of our contributors come from all around the AB wilderness, and we wanted to show respect for those who have gone before and also those that are here now, human or otherwise. So those were big ideas that we came to.
Trudy, I was hoping that you would read a bit from the introduction.
Our intention with this atlas is to reflect that visceral need for humans to be engaged with the natural world through time. What is gained and what is lost when we see it as separate? Boundaries don't reflect the nature of the holistic system. If wilderness is seen as separate, something that is not us, is there a danger that it becomes just another commodity? Wilderness is more than just a place you go to get away or a destination on a checklist. The essays in this atlas demonstrate that what we do outside wilderness affects the resources within, and what happens in wilderness matters to us immensely. In that sense, the boundaries are meaningless.
I was particularly struck by the tension you raise between reverence for nature and this new sense of wilderness as commodity and recreation as consumption. How do you balance the tension between wilderness protection and recreation?
Yeah, I think that is a tension. That's the modern dilemma of wilderness management. And, you know, I've made the statement that wilderness, wildlands in all areas, whether it's your backyard park or your, you know, big expedition to the AB wilderness, you know, needs to be more than a backdrop to your workout, for example. And so I guess what I'm suggesting, and I'm not the only one, but I'm suggesting that people approach it with reverence. And, you know, whatever pace that is, as long as you approach it with respect and reverence, then we'll be better off.
Mary, you're nodding your head.
Well, I guess for me as a vegetation ecologist, I have spent a fair bit of time both working in and around the AB for the Forest Service and then recreating, whether it's in the winter backcountry skiing or in the fall hiking. I think for me, I just marvel at every little thing I see, whether it's just a little piece of lichen on a rock or the larger landscape. So I agree with Trouty. If we can instill that reverence and respect and awe, we'll be better off in terms of our relationship with those systems that are becoming rarer and rarer and that much more important, in my opinion.
Maybe, Aaron, you could also speak to that if you wanted as well.
I think it's a central question of our relationship with nature in the modern world today. And a problem that we have is that people are spending less and less time in the natural world. And so there's this dislocation that is happening. At the same time, when people do go out, it's often with a conquest mentality. And it's really important that people get into wild nature to develop a relationship with it. But it's also important when we talk about reverence and connection that people slow down when they're there. And that's the value of wilderness, capital W, designated wilderness. You can't mountain bike. You can't bring motorized things in there. And I mountain bike, right? So I'm not saying it's bad, but what I'm saying is you need to be able to slow down, to leave yourself room, to have a deeper connection with this biological system that underpins all of human life on this planet. So finding that balance is the trick. You know, in the past, we're kind of creating these zones where people don't live. In the past, people lived in these places. There was a very different relationship with the natural world. But we've constructed a modern society that has a very dualistic relationship with nature. And so we need to find a way to move beyond that and recapture this deeper relationship while at the same time leaving room for that system to thrive without our impact on it. So that's the challenge. It's not easy. I think that people are getting better at it. But to me, that's one of the real values of wilderness areas.
I agree, yeah. Aaron. And I think that we need to take that mindset back home with us and try to do things at a more human pace.
I want to talk about another place of tension in the book, which is around privilege. In Shane Doyle's piece, The Absalika People and the Absorica Beartooth Wilderness, he writes, "Looking back 33 years later, I understand now how far I had to go to reacquire what was lost when my tribe was relocated from the Absarica Beartooths to the eastern edge of our reservation." So I also want to ask how we hold a dual consciousness about wilderness protection and the atrocities that have been committed on the same land during settlement.
Yeah, I wish Shane was here to answer that question. And I think he does it very well in his essay, and he's done so very well in the book events that we've had. One of the things that I think is important to make a case for is that the Crow are still here. They're not relics. And so I think he makes that point in his essay, as does Lauren Rausch, who also has an essay in the book. He is not Crow, but he teaches Crow youth on the Crow Reservation, and he does value, and the kids, he takes them back out and reacquaints them with the landscape. But his essay is about what he has learned from Crow youth. For example, there is no traditional Crow word for designated wilderness. It's just a foreign concept to them. So I think that's the best that I can do to answer that particular question.
Mary, you're a vegetation ecologist, and as a girl, your mother used to say that you were into dirt and weeds. You work for the U.S. Forest Service, and I was hoping that you would just lead us into your piece by reading the beginning.
Okay. The title is Amazing Aspen, and I do want to say I had a hard time with choosing an adjective for aspen. But if you read the piece and learn about the life history strategies and the adaptation that aspen have developed, it's pretty amazing, actually. Okay, I'll read. "We all love to see and hear the trembling of aspen leaves, whether it's when the leaves are bright lime green in the spring or vibrant yellow, orange, and red in the fall. The flattened petioles, or leaf stems, are responsible for the trembling of these elegant trees as they sway in the breeze or dance in the wind. The lively leaves, coupled with the alluring white-gray bark, make these trees perfect subjects for photographs and paintings. Each fall, we marvel at the vibrant patchwork quilt of brightly colored aspen stands playing across the landscape."
Out of all the vegetation you could have chosen, why aspen?
Well, actually, I would say that it was not necessarily one I chose, but it's one I volunteered to work on. I also wrote an essay on cottonwood that we're going to see where that goes. But I actually would do any species Trouty asked me to do because I love plants and I just love writing about them. So I would have taken anything.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Trouty Perry, Mary Manning, and Aaron Teasdale of the Voices of Yellowstone's Capstone, a narrative atlas of the Absarica Beartooth Wilderness. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
One of the things I admire so much about this book is it asks a lot of questions and doesn't answer them in concrete. And
The question I had, or that was raised in your piece, Mary, was what are the key places of tension for aspens as we move into climate change?
Right, and it's a mixed bag. And I did, one of the things I really enjoyed doing and I always start out doing is just pouring through the literature and some really old seminal pieces and then the more recent work that's been done. It truly is a mixed bag because of a number of adaptation strategies that aspen has. You know, Trouty mentioned lodgepole pine, and what we're seeing now is even though lodgepole pines that exhibit srotony or have cones that open in response to fire, if there's a repeated fire cycle, they never mature to the point where they can develop cones. And so we're seeing shifts in composition, basically dominant vegetation is shifting. And so in the Absaroka Beartooth in the surrounding area, which I've done a fair bit of aspen working in the Beartooth face and stuff, we're seeing that shift. And so aspen in some regard as an early cereal, you know, gets to the site first, shade intolerant, likes the sun. It is opportunistic because, again, it regenerates from a root crown primarily. So it's vegetative regeneration. And I think that in that regard, it may reoccupy areas that traditionally supported conifers with longer fire rotation intervals. So it's all playing out in front of us. And Trouty and I know that at the head of East Rosebud, that's classic. And I got to go out and sample the vegetation, the aspen out there many years ago. So it's actually an exciting drama, in my opinion.
This is the mixture of the science and the human story. So you mentioned Shane's tribal story, and Mary's providing a little science, and Aaron will get us back to the human dimensions of things. So I was glad to hear that.
In terms of the human drama, Aaron, you wrote a piece called What the Mountains Give Three Generations in the Beartooths. And I'm going to start by asking, what do the mountains give?
I think the mountains give us many things. On their surface, they give us striking visual beauty that everyone seems to appreciate. In practical terms, in the modern world, they give us places that are difficult to develop. So they've become places that we now call wilderness. I think for so many of us as individuals who go to the mountains, they give us a place to have a relationship with a world that we spend far too little time in. Mountains also teach us humility. Whether you're an athlete seeking to summit them or someone who just wants to walk among their beauty, they are these things that tower above us and show us our place in the larger planetary system that we live in. And we realize we are small. We realize that we can't just get to the top if we want to. You know, I mean, I'm getting older now, so it's harder for me to do some of the things I used to do. And they teach me how to age with grace and how to still appreciate that beauty without being able to get to the top sometimes. I think there's many lessons in the mountains if we're open to listening.
I was hoping you'd read the beginning of your piece.
What the Mountains Give. It was their first journey into the Beartooths when my sons learned to speak marmot, the chirps and whistles of the jumbo ground squirrels providing reliable accompaniment to the high country saunters here. Silas and Jonah instantly bonded with the cherubic mammals. Their youthful voice boxes allowed them to mimic the high-pitched language with surprising fidelity. At least I thought so. The marmots may have been less impressed with their attempts at interspecies fellowship, but that didn't stop the boys from whistling and calling with childhood vigor as we ambled through the mountains. My own relationship with Beartooth marmots stretches back to my increasingly distant youth, when my father began taking me into these mountains as a child. Though the country's unruly character eventually won my heart, it was the wildlife that first sparked my ardor. The elk herds, hundreds strong, viewed from a cliff top at sunset, in a cool, dusky meadow far below. The young bear, the first I'd seen while on my own feet rather than inside a vehicle, that scampered away in mountain forest. And the marmots. I loved the marmots and attempted to bring them home with me via the photographs I amassed, crawling across the tundra for hours, ever closer for the best possible shots. To my dad's exasperation, after picking up our photos from the lab later, he found roll after roll of film filled with their buck-toothed visages.
I couldn't help but notice one of the photographs accompanying your pieces from one of your sons, of a marmot.
Indeed, yeah. That's the full circle marmot effect that happened here, is that, you know, it's family lore in my family about this fascination that I had with marmots. And literally my dad going through rolls of film, marmot after marmot, because I kept getting a little bit closer and the pictures were better. So I had to keep shooting. And the funny thing is, you know, then when my kids got big enough, I think 8 or so, we started bringing them with us. So we had 3 generations back there. And it was hysterical to see my older boy, Silas, take my camera and start doing the exact thing that I had done 30 years before. And marmot picture after marmot picture. You know, I think it speaks to the relationship that we have, the inherent relationship that we have to other animals that we share this planet with. But just to see that, it was all of a sudden, I was my dad watching me. Mm-hmm. And the cycles continue.
I think that reflects the intergenerational aspect of the voices that we were trying to incorporate into the Atlas as well. So we have pieces in the beginning of the book by Todd Burritt, a new wilderness ranger, but also Jonathan Marquis. So very young voices, maybe not as young as your son, but very young voices. And we also have the voice of Hank Raitt, who is in his 80s, was the last district ranger at Stillwater, or on the Stillwater Ranger District at Nye. So another essay is by Jesse Logan, and he goes out with Bo Fredland, a much younger man, and, you know, the same lessons that are shared across the generations as you travel through that landscape. So that was another aspect of the different voices we were trying to capture.
I'm going to end on a question from Jesse Logan's piece, but I have one more question to throw to you, Aaron, which is, in your piece, you write, the value of preserving this wilderness, that self-willed landscape, unmolested by humanity's all-encompassing grip, is something I try to pass on to the boys. And I, again, was wondering about what it means to be a part of an ecosystem and apart from an ecosystem.
I think it really boils down to respect. And I insist that we're a part of these systems at our core. At the same time, we obviously recognize that, you know, our species has overrun the planet and we're having very deleterious effects on these natural systems. And so we have to have the requisite sensitivity when we're in these places, understanding the larger context, right? I would argue that we're only apart from it in our minds, and that's a construct. And that what I suggest would benefit humanity as a whole would be to lose that sense of separateness and to understand that this is our home. And when we're in these places, when we're in wild nature, we are home.
In his piece about wolverines, co-editor Jesse Logan asks, if the wolverine disappears, what of humanity vanishes with it? And my call is to ask, you know, if this ecosystem, if the AB wilderness were to disappear bit by bit, what of humanity would vanish with it?
I think it goes back a little bit to what Aaron was saying. It's in our DNA. Humans have engaged with this landscape on a daily basis for thousands of years. And so it's in our DNA. And how do you move forward as a species that is compassionate, that respects the past, respects the future, respects those who aren't here yet, if you don't have that foundation of wilderness?
I have an answer that's very strange. I think the bigger question is, how many of us know what we will lose if we don't? How many people value and have the awareness because every day on this planet we are losing species that we either have not even identified or cataloged or see the value in. So somebody could say, well, wolverine, what value does wolverine have? If we need to just step back from even that and just acknowledge that we're one of many, many species on this planet, and we can't even, you know, the old expression, nature is more complex than we can think. And if there's people who don't even know what they've lost, I think that's what this book does, is help to instill and provide awareness, instill appreciation and provide awareness for what we do have, so that we can be more sensitive to what we might lose in the future.
I mean, I think there's a lot of philosophical answers to that question, yeah. But I'll kind of keep mine to the human level. You know, animals, wildlife inspires us, and you see that time and time again. I mean, when you're spending time in the Beartooths or the Absarokas, the Greater Yellowstone, think about people that come from urban environments and the reaction they have to seeing wildlife. You know, even a deer, you know, it's like life-changing for these people. And when they see a bear, a grizzly bear, I mean, you know, it is something that they will tell people about for the rest of their lives. And, you know, for me personally, I spend a lot of time in the mountains, and I didn't see a wolverine for the first time until a few years ago. Mm. I'd come across fresh tracks. I'd found their scat. I was a tech on a wildlife study years ago. I tracked them. But I had never seen a real wolverine, and boy, did I want to see a wolverine. And my children had never seen a wolverine, so I'm skiing with my son, and we see wolverine tracks. So we follow the tracks to a high point where we can look across a vast area, and there down below is a wolverine. And it's spring, and there's a marmot there, and we watch this wolverine and this marmot have this little face-off where the wolverine's trying to get closer to the marmot who's standing next to its hole. And the wolverine's just going to give it a shot, right? But the marmot knows exactly the point at which it needs to duck into that hole, and the wolverine never gets it. And we just sat there. It was like we were watching the best movie we'd ever seen. And we just sat there in this high point on the mountainside. And, you know, my son now has a wolverine poster on his wall. We marvel at the beauty of these animals. We're amazed at what wolverines can do, the sheer mountainsides they can climb, you know, the way they hunt mountain goats. Their ferocity, they show us that incredible things are possible by the animals that we share this world with. So I think that their value is actually impossible to put into words, but it's great.
Trouty Perry is the AB Atlas project leader. She worked for the U.S. Forest Service for over 31 years, most recently as the Beartooth District Ranger on the Custer-Gallatin National Forest outside of Red Lodge. Mary Manning is the regional vegetation ecologist for the northern region of the U.S. Forest Service in Missoula, Montana. And Aaron Teasdale is an outdoor writer and photographer based in Missoula, Montana. He's won numerous writing awards and was named 2016 Travel Writer of the Year by the Society of American Travel Writers. Look for more information about them and their work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bo Baker, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.